Historian Catherine Kalaitis continues to offer unique insights and observations at Religion Dispatches on the religious aspects of the ongoing war of aggression in Ukraine. And I wanted to have her back to assess the impact the holy war rhetoric spewing from Kremlin is having on the faith. Katie, welcome back to State of Belief Radio. You wrote this week that with the war having passed the 100-day mark, we've now seen a notable religious defection. Talk about that, please.
Thank you so much for having me back. And I'm absolutely happy to talk about this because I think it's such an important aspect of what is going on in Ukraine and beyond. So the Patriarch of Moscow, Kirill, has shown himself over the course of the past 100 plus days to be basically a lackey of Vladimir Putin. And I don't think that's too extreme of a thing to say. And the consequence has been, you know, some significant defections, beginning, I would say, with St. Nicholas of Amsterdam, which was a Moscow Patriarchate church in Amsterdam that has a pretty prominent place in the Orthodox Christian peace movement, such as it exists, right? There isn't this strong pacifist tradition in what is essentially an imperial tradition in Christianity. But they voted to leave after, you know, frankly, I would argue receiving threats. They voted to leave the Moscow Patriarchate. St. Sergius Seminary in Paris, which is an incredibly important seminary that only recently in the past, you know, 3 or 4 years has gone back to Moscow. There's an open letter from students asking to go to Constantinople, to leave the jurisdiction of Moscow. And then, of course, most significantly, last week, the Orthodox Church of the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, the Moscow Patriarchate Church in Ukraine, voted in their synodal meeting to leave Moscow, to break with Moscow. This is the most significant and high-profile defection from Moscow. Certainly, it's the most immediately related to the war itself. Mm.
For a religious tradition that speaks in terms of millennia, how significant is that rift?
I would give the response that Ho Chi Minh gave when he was asked in the 1960s what he thought about the French Revolution, which is too soon to tell. But I think that it is, you know, Moscow in many ways needs Kiev. Its claim to legitimacy is deeply bound up in the baptism of the Kievan Rus. Kiev, not Moscow, is the mother city of Slavic Orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. And there is a, you know, there's first the political fallout, which is, you know, Russia is attempting to use the Russian Orthodox Church as an instrument of Russian soft power, and it needs these sort of satellites all over the world. But there's also, I think, the very real sort of psychic blow that is. If Moscow is, in theory, the inheritor of Kiev, and to lose Kiev, to lose churches that have been loyal to Moscow, you know, in the face of some pretty significant political upheavals, that is a major blow, I would say.
So what led to this Synod decision? And you tell us, what are the real life implications of this?
Yeah, I mean, so the main, you know, if you read the Synod's decision, if you read the sort of comments, you know, sort of rhetoric leading up to it, the failure of Patriarch Kirill to condemn the violence in Ukraine, to acknowledge Ukrainian culture and history as distinct and separate, but mainly, you know, his failure to condemn the violence and his insistence on painting the war as righteous was the main reason. You know, the Ukrainian church that was loyal to Moscow was in a virtually impossible situation. The members of their flock were being slaughtered, and that slaughter was being defended by a man who every Sunday over the altar they were supposed to pray for and commemorate as their chief pastor and shepherd.
Yeah.
People aren't going to do that, right? Yeah. I mean, people just simply, the reality is, in the liturgy, in the Orthodox Mass, we commemorate our chief bishop over the altar. We also understand the Eucharist in part to be, when you take the Eucharist in the Orthodox tradition, you are pledging loyalty. One of the things you are doing is you are pledging loyalty to that chain of bishops. Mm-hmm. And when you're asking people to do that, that becomes impossible. There's also the fact that, that the church loyal to Moscow was coming under intense pressure both from vigilantes and from the Ukrainian government. I think that's more complicated when we talk about issues of religious freedom, but they were finding themselves under both moral, legal, and physical pressure to leave.
Hmm. How heavily is Moscow leaning on religious rhetoric at this point to justify ongoing war of aggression?
I think Moscow believes that that religious rhetoric is their best argument for the war in Ukraine. They are, if you listen to the speeches that Vladimir Putin has given, that Patriarch Kirill has given, that Patriarch Kirill's deputies have given, they are, their chief argument, one has to remember, the chief argument of Russia in this situation ultimately is that Ukraine is part of Russia. Mm-hmm. That Ukraine and Russia are one nation, are one people. This argument is entirely founded in the history of Slavic Orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. And that is, they have to rely on that rhetoric. They have to rely on that history to make that argument. They also, Vladimir Putin and Kirill, part of their friendship, as it were, such as it is founded on this sort of traditionalist alliance that feeds into this history, a very orthodox understanding of the world, that Russia is meant to be, is chosen to be this guardian of the true faith and of, morality against a decadent and heretical West. And so the righteousness of Russia's cause are really founded in those two principles, and everything about it is religious, right? It's founded in this religious history, and it's deployed with this religious rhetoric.
The Russian Orthodox Patriarch has made several outrageous statements in recent weeks in service to Putin, but Russia's not that religious a nation. Is that a mirror of the kind of religion matters because it says what we want to hear, dynamic, so common on the American political religious right?
I think it's slightly more complicated than you see in America, because I think our understanding of what is and is not religious is really colored by this Reformation understanding of religion, of Christianity in particular, as a matter of personal faith. In Orthodox countries, and I would say in Catholicism, though to a lesser extent, because Catholicism had much more exposure to Protestant understandings of religiosity. Religion is not just about personal faith, but about communal creed. So you hear people all the time talk about how awful it is to be like an LDS missionary in Greece. Because even if you convince them of the truth of Joseph Smith's revelation, they don't convert, because the idea is I'm Greek, so I'm Orthodox. And so I think one of the things that's important to look at when you look at a place like Russia is, things that we associate in majority Protestant Western countries with religious faith, things like regular church attendance, prayer, belief in God, right, are very low in Russia. But most Russians still identify themselves as Orthodox Christians. And so that part of it is religion tells us what we want to hear. And I think there's absolutely, there's an amount of Russian, like, sort of just nationalist pride that's caught up in that. But it's also important to remember that that nationalist pride is absolutely bound up with Russia's Orthodox identity, regardless of the personal faith of individuals.
So right now, where are religiously oriented peacemaking efforts coming from?
They're coming from inside Russia. And I want to be very clear that there have been some very brave priests and bishops in Russia, including, you know, men who are standing trial right now for speaking up against the violence in Ukraine. Russia has experienced a severe crackdown on religious and political dissidents over the course of the past 3 months, over the past, you know, year and a half. It's gotten worse, but certainly since the war in Ukraine. And there are people within Russia, there are clergymen within Russia who are speaking out against the war, and they're suffering greatly for it. And, you know, I think it's important to note that in the Orthodox tradition, many of our priests are married. We have both a celibate and a married clergy. So some of these men are putting their families in danger as well. Mm-hmm. And their bravery cannot be underestimated. There is also outside of Russia in the Orthodox world, I think a real, certainly St. Nicholas in Amsterdam, the Archbishop of Finland, Leo, has spoken out pretty, and he is, you know, they're an autocephalous church with strong ties to Moscow. Lithuania has now sought its autonomy from Moscow, naming Kirill as the problem and naming the war as the problem. The Orthodox tradition has a very unusual relationship to war writ large, right? So we don't have just war theory, but war is always a sin. There's the idea that people who have returned from a battle should be excommunicated for 3 years. We kind of acknowledge war is necessary, but always sinful, which is, I think, for a lot of Western Christians, an unusual way of thinking about something. But there have been, particularly in this instance where it is a fratricidal war, there have been voices speaking out against Vladimir Putin, against Kirill. There are now voices in the Orthodox world saying, you know, the Russian church just needs to be cut off. The five ancient patriarchs need to get together and cut Kirill off. Like, he needs to be done ecclesiastical manner as well. He needs to be done in an ecclesiastical manner as well. Wow. So there is that voice of dissent, and I think that's really important to note. Mm.
I wanted to ask you about the argument for sanctioning the Russian patriarch that you wrote about recently. What are the precedents, and how might such sanctions be helpful?
Yeah, so we, throughout the war on terror, and I have scare quotes. I know you can't see me, only hear me, but there are scare quotes. Throughout the war on terror, it was not unusual for the United States and for other Western governments, and even before that, for example, after the Iranian Revolution, it has not been uncommon in our involvement in the Middle East as we fight Islamic terrorism to sanction religious leaders. With the idea that those religious leaders are absolutely at the root of the violence we are attempting to punish. Kirill has not yet been sanctioned. The EU is pushing, I think, increasingly towards sanctions. That talk has kind of disappeared in the United States that he will be sanctioned. Just to be very clear, in terms of the practical effects of Patriarch Kirill's real life, they are zero. He is not going to go vacation in Disney World. But I think symbolically, it is important to say, and I would extend that not just to Patriarch Kirill, but also to people like Metropolitan Hilarion and Metropolitan Tikhon, who are some chief deputies of his. It is important to say part of the problem is them. They are feeding the rhetoric. They are whipping up the troops. They are whipping up the arguments for this violence. They are just as culpable as a mullah in Afghanistan telling the Taliban to go kill, or an imam in Saudi Arabia radicalizing young men, because that's what this is. And I think that's very important. I think if Patriot Carrell were wearing, were an Ayatollah, I don't think there would be a question.
Well, Katie, you have given us a lot to think about and a lot of information that we need to have. What else are you seeing that, before we go, that's important for our listeners to understand or to look forward to?
Yeah, so I think the next – Moscow has signaled that it may not let the Ukrainian church go quietly. They have reiterated that they need the permission of Carrell. I think one thing to watch is as not just the Ukrainian church, which is obviously we know different, but places like Lithuania start to seek autonomy or autocephaly from Moscow, how Moscow reacts. I often feel that I'm sort of an accomplice in this, but I want people in the West who maybe are unfamiliar with Orthodoxy to be aware that there's a conflict within Orthodoxy, and there are many, many Orthodox Christians who disagree with not just with Carrell, but in the larger debate within our tradition about how we relate to modernity, how we relate to things like human rights. That's a debate we're having within our tradition, and it is a debate. It is an active and lively debate. Mm-hmm. I actually, next week, will be in Seacliff, New York, for a conference called Women's Orthodoxy and War Conference with people like Sister Vasa Lauren, who are, where people are speaking out. These are, except for me, the women who organize this conference are all from within the Russian tradition, and they are concerned about giving a voice from within the Russian tradition that is opposed to the war and that speaks for another part of our tradition. So I would ask people to watch that debate, to not see the voice of Orthodoxy as being monolithic, but understanding that we are experiencing, probably the greatest ecclesiological crisis in our history since the fall of Constantinople. And I would argue, and people would disagree with me at this, but I would argue a sort of religious conflict on par with the Protestant Reformation.
Mm. Catherine Kalaitis is a writer and historian whose work focuses on early medieval Christianity and contemporary Orthodox identity. You can follow her writing on the role of religion in the ongoing war in Ukraine at religiondispatches.org. Katie, it's always good to be with you. Thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. We so appreciate that. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was. Yeah.